name's Doug. I'm an alcoholic. No readings. I thought I was off the hook for a couple minutes anyway. But thank you very much for having me. We had a good trip down, and I thank my buddy Jim for coming down with me and providing this huge watch. So there's hope. I will not go over. For those of you who are fathers, congratulations on Father's Day. And it wouldn't be bad if it wasn't on. Also, too, congratulations to Billy and Lynn for launching another child off on a big adventure. And congratulations. I'm sure she won't do as well of a job with them as you did. And I guess this shows why I'm single. I think everybody ought to elope and get married by an Elvis impersonator at a Las Vegas wedding chapel, you know, so that would make it easier for everybody. So thank you very much for having me, and I will drink my coffee. Normally I get coffee and I just kind of swing it around with me for an hour and never take anything out of it, and everybody's watching the coffee go, and this time I think I will use it. I have a home group. I am a member of the Old Town Speakers Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. We meet at 8 p.m. on Friday evening in Old Town Alexandria. It's a one-hour speaker meeting. The coffee's great, and our speakers have a solid message of recovery. I also have a sobriety date, which is the 13th of October, 1994. It's not my first sobriety date. That first one was the 19th of September, 1988. And then I had another one several weeks after that. And I had a few more that year. And I had a bunch more over the next 4 years. So I'm certainly not a first nighter because I was under the impression, I heard this early on in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I filtered it through my keen alcoholic mind, and what I heard was just don't drink, go to meetings. Now, I thought that was the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. So that's what I would do. I would just not drink, and I would park my behind in a chair at a meeting, went to lots of meetings, and I just sat there. And usually I thought about how much I wanted to drink. And eventually, I would think I would rather be drunk than go through another minute of this. And then I'd go out and drink again. And I did that for over 5 years. I'm sure that the message was related to me, that just don't drink and go to meetings, but certainly is a good idea, is not the program of recovery of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I didn't hear it. So I just didn't drink and went to meetings. And then for a while I was the poster child. I said I would never go to a meeting drunk. And then I started showing up at meetings drunk. And I'd just park myself in the front or the back, and I'd be the guy with his head down, his hair sticking straight up, and his eyes red, and couldn't talk. And I don't know what I was expecting, but I got exactly what I was putting into Alcoholics Anonymous. Nada. Nothing. I wasn't putting anything in. And consequently, that's what I was getting out of it. Now, I wound up going to Alcoholics Anonymous is because I was having a little problem with my drinking, is the way I put it. Yeah, I don't go into which one of my ancestors was found dead in a ditch or anything like that, because for me that's not important, because what someone else did with their drinking had absolutely no, is not the reason I'm an alcoholic. I'm an army brat. The moving around is not the reason I'm alcoholic. I wasn't looking for too many people to blame for my alcoholism. And I am, if nothing else, I am grateful for that. I wasn't interested in finding out who is responsible for my being a drunk. But I knew rather quickly that I was having problems with alcohol, like the second week I drank. I started when I was 14 years old, which was, 1965. If you like to know these things and want to place me, I was born February 1951. I started drinking when I was 14 years old. I got sober in 94, so I was 43 years old. I've never been married, don't have any kids, got one dog. So that's, you don't have to worry about trying to figure any of that stuff out. But I started drinking at 14, and I really couldn't say much. I have no idea whether I was a born alcoholic. I don't know if it's genetic. I don't know if it's environmental. I know I've got alcoholism. For me, that's the important thing to know to the core of my being, is I am an alcoholic. How that happened might be nice, but I'm a chump and I believe almost anything I hear, so you could tell me anything and I'd say, oh, yeah, that's right. But all I need to know is I'm an alcoholic. I cannot safely drink alcohol. Everything else is might be nice, but I found out it is not necessary for my recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I learned about geographics long before I ever drank, because being an Army brat, we took geographics about every 18 months to 2 years. And I know now, I didn't know it then, but I know now with hindsight, is I was always looking for that geographic cure long before I ever started drinking. It was Okinawa. Okinawa is the problem. Once we get off this rock, everything will be fine. And then it was, well, Fort Eustis is a problem. It's hot and swampy here, and I don't like the place. And if we just got out of Eustis, then everything would be so much better. And then you can fill in the blanks. Carlisle Barracks up in Pennsylvania, Fort Sam, several times at Eustis, down in Florida, again to Texas, out in California, Okinawa, you know, on and on and on. So I was looking for that. I go someplace else and something is going to change. Well, yeah, the locality changed and the opportunity to do something changed, but that would take some action on my part, and I wasn't big into action. I'm big into thinking. You know, I got to figure this out. If I could just figure it out, something's going to change. So I was always looking for something to change somewhere else. It's because somewhere around 7 or 8 is, you know, before then, I remember, you know, you hit the front door as a little kid, and it was just, something fun's going to happen out there. I know, especially at Fort Sam was a lot of fun, Fort Sam, Houston, Texas, and San Antonio, and when we were at Okinawa, because this was not long after the Second World War, and we were digging up caches of Japanese grenades, and we had a old Japanese machine gun nest right across the street, and we could build caves, and we could do all sorts of, you know, I mean, it was just a kid's paradise. And, you know, you hit that front door, and you're excited. Now, something good is going to happen. And then somewhere around 7 or so, I'd hit the front door, and I'd kind of go like that. Ugh, something bad is going to happen. Nothing good is going to happen out there. So I started listening to my own head projecting the wreckage of the future. Maybe it happened, maybe not. But I was always tensed up. And what do they mean by that? Why'd they say that? And what, you know, I know I'm going to fall off the bike. I know something bad's going to happen. I know I'm going to be in trouble. Why didn't I do this? Why didn't I study for this test? Or I'm going to fail this test and I never could walk it back, is because you didn't study for the test. You know, I couldn't see that part. I was just all concerned about failing. And so that's my head started talking to me a lot and pointing out a lot of things to me. And my head didn't seem to like me a whole lot. So that's what I brought to my first drinking experience, and it was complete. It was unplanned, out of the blue, impulsive. It was a Friday night. It was Tampa, Florida, is exactly like Northern Virginia, probably exactly like Madison, usually in the summer, hot and humid, and thunderstorms roll through, and then they're over, and then the streets just steam for a while, and then off you go. Well, it just suddenly occurred to me, my parents are out at someone else's house. And my father did a lot of official entertaining, so he had quite a nice bar. And I just went to that bar, I opened it up, and had at it. Now, I'd been around drinkers all my life. Real, honest-to-God, social drinkers. The kind where everybody was married, everybody had been married one time, and they were with the man or woman they had married, and they would come over to people's houses, and they would get some sort of drink, and then they would get food, and almost everybody smoked them, so somehow they had a little plate of food, a drink, a cigarette, and they kind of worked the room talking, and not really drinking a whole lot. I'd never seen anybody drunk in my life. And I'd been to cocktail parties, been to them and observed them, never saw anybody drunk. Now, maybe they hustled them out, I have no idea, but I never saw a falling down drunk. I seen my father tipsy one time in his life, and that was when he was promoted to Major General. And they were having a promotion party, and you could just see he was a little bit more lit up than I'd ever seen him, but still perfectly coherent. That's what I was raised around. Now, what I did that Friday night is I started at the left and just worked my way over to the right. You know, poured a bunch of stuff into a tumbler, whoom, went to the next bottle, whoom, and waited for something to happen. And in about 15 minutes, it happened. Exactly like you'd expect. You pour that much alcohol into somebody who's never had a drink in his life. Or, you know, I'd had little sips off of beer, but really drank, and I just hit the floor, and my head was spinning around, and holy smoke! Yeah, I couldn't put two coherent thoughts together. I don't remember throwing up, and I didn't black out, but you know, I was really felt it, and I had a hangover the next day. I intuitively knew how to start dealing with these hangovers. Like, I didn't make any sudden moves. I knew if I made a sudden move, I was going over. And I was really hungry, but I knew intuitively if I ate anything, it wasn't going to stay down too long. And my mouth felt like a buzzard had puked in it, and, you know, it was humid and hot, and my head hurt, and I was sweating, and it was just, oh, God. And I didn't say, I'm never doing this again. I didn't say that one time. Because the following Friday, I did the exact same thing. Although this time I left off the green stuff. I was already trying to control it. I figured the green stuff, which I later found out was cream de menthe, I figured, man, that did it to me. So I had never had a drink of cream de menthe since. And I didn't drink any more green stuff until I discovered NyQuil in the Army, you know, and that's some great green stuff. If you're not done drinking yet, I would suggest NyQuil. It's 50 proof. Start it when you think you got a cold coming on and see what happens with it. But I drank plenty of NyQuil, but not for years and years. And so my pattern was set. I was a weekend drunk. I very quickly, that my father locked up the liquor cabinet. Now, we're a quiet family. We didn't point things out like, what are you doing drinking all the liquor? What are you doing drinking at all? You know, that would never be said in my family. It was, I got the idea when suddenly there was a lock on the liquor cabinet. Well, I wanted, there was a big liquor store, Gandy Avenue Liquors, a couple miles from the base. I just hang out there and get a GI or an old drunk to get me a fifth. And fine stuff, Old Heaven Hill bourbon, $2.95 a fifth. Probably still $2.95 a fifth. Well, I tell you, I don't think it was top shelf stuff. But that was set for me. I wanted whiskey. I wanted my own bottle. I didn't want to be around people when I drank. You know, so the idea, teenage social drinking at that time was a bunch of guys, get some beer, get in somebody's car, drink beer, hoot and holler at the girls, throw beer cans out the window. I wanted none of that stuff. I wanted my bottle, I wanted to be by myself, and I wanted to drink until what I found out, the magic for me is my head shut up. My head was perfectly okay to be with the rest of me. I guess maybe some good psychobabble was my mind, emotions, and body were integrated then. You know, I just thought I was headed towards unconsciousness is what was happening. But, you know, that's what I looked for. And that's why I drank at 14, and that's why I drank at 43. You know, so that part was remarkably consistent. I didn't start, I was a daily drinker at 18 because we'd been transferred up to Northern Virginia. And I went to school in the district, and you could, at the time, you could drink beer and wine at 18 legally in the district. And it suddenly occurred to me as I was walking to the school, it was way beyond my intellectual firepower, that maybe this thing would go a lot smoother if I just ducked into this bar that opened up at about 6 in the morning and drank my breakfast. And the thought came into my head, and I immediately acted on it. So I started drinking Budweiser for breakfast, and it did seem to make that place go a little bit smoother. And, you know, I almost failed out of it, the place. But amazed to everybody, I did graduate 151 out of 157. So there were 6 people who did worse than I did. They're probably, you know, software millionaires now. Who knows? I scraped out of there. And surprisingly, there's a college somewhere in the world who will take anybody. And I had found one of those schools that'd take me. Except I was lying in bed one night, and I know this was June, and it suddenly occurred to me that I didn't want to go to college. I figured college was just high school somewhere else, and I just escaped that place and had hated every minute of it. So why would I voluntarily go do it again? So got to thinking, and in 1969, you had 2 options. You went to college, or you went in the military. Because if you didn't go in the military, you were going to go in the military in the draft. My draft number was 13. So 13 is my lucky number. I was born on the 13th. My sobriety date's on the 13th. My draft number was 13. You know, so 13 is my lucky number. I figured I was gone anyway. So I decided to join the Army. And the next day I joined the Army. And thank God that I went to Europe, not to Vietnam. And when I did get orders for Vietnam, I was always able to skate out of it one way or the other. I had a brother over there the first time, and the second time I didn't have enough time left. So thank God for that, you know. But Europe started what I call the grown-up problems. That's where I started having blackouts. Now, I lasted until I was 20 years old before I had a blackout. Now, we all have our parts to play in life. As an active alcoholic, my part was to drink like a pig. And I drank like a pig. I have no idea why I never had a blackout until I was 20 years old. No idea at all. I drank just as much as I could hold at any one time, but for whatever reason, the switch didn't click. And that changed when I was 20 years old. I came out of a wine festival in Würzburg, Germany. I was with the 3rd Infantry Division. And there you drank at a liter beer steins, and this is good German young white wine. And I had had like 3 liters of that stuff. And I was standing at an intersection trying to figure out how to get across the intersection. I mean, this was not working, you know. They had a little white man walking along, and then it looked like they had a little red man walking along, and they were both blinking at me, and, you know, I couldn't figure out whether, so I just kind of hung on to the light post. And the next thing I remember is I woke up in the barracks, and it was the next day. And I thought, cool, this is really slick. You know, I don't have to even be conscious of where I'm going, and I wind up where I want to go. You know, that's really slick, you know. So blackouts didn't bother me at all. And I usually wound up where I expected to go. By the time I stopped drinking in my 40s, I was blacking out 4 or 5 times a week. So I certainly made up for that teenage not blacking out. And I was wrecking vehicles, and I was getting in trouble with the military, you know, because it never occurred to me, but I did find out, is I have a problem with authority. And acting out on that in the Army is not the way to do it. Because as I had a sergeant when I was first losing stripes says, he said, well, I won't tell you what he called me, but he said, the Army can raise the hassle level to the infinite degree. I remember that. The Army can raise the hassle level to the infinite degree. We will spend millions to put you in jail and leave you there. We don't care. And it makes real good sense to me now. It did make a lot of good sense to me then. So, you know, I was having problems with the Army. You know, nothing big. I just spent like overnights in the stockade and things like that. And I never gave my drinking a second thought. It just didn't occur to me that this was any kind of problem. Now, I could sit down and say every time I went to the stockade, I'd been drinking. Every time. Every time I shot off my mouth and lost another stripe, I had been drinking. Every time I wrecked a vehicle, I had been drinking. And I couldn't put those two together. I didn't think about it. I did escape the Army. I went to college because I didn't want to work. You know, I didn't want to learn anything especially. I just didn't want to work. And I figured I could hide out in school, which, you know, I picked a school because it had the same name as my high school. Yeah. There was absolutely no other reason I went to this school, but I just leafing through college book, and I said, hey, I recognize that place, and I went there. It was in Spokane, Washington. I didn't even know it was called Spokane. I was calling it Spokane for 4 months, you know, because that's the way it's spelled. So my academic career was non-existent. I was just kind of hanging out. You know, I just wanted to stay drunk and high and just kind of lay down in People's Park and go skiing and just kind of drive around, not do anything. And I had a lot of people seem to have this South American agricultural import business. I was in that for a while. You know, loved that job, but The state prison in Washington is in Walla Walla, Washington, the town they liked so well they named it twice. And I just looked at that and, you know, said, you know what? And this is the 70s, so it was, they're throwing guys in there forever. They were doing the exact same thing I'm doing. Now, I'm just doing it so I can stay all smoked up and buy all the drinking supplies I need in an apartment and, you know, a little money, things like that. But they're going to see it as a criminal enterprise. And my sponsors were big into this, too. One sponsor, he kept saying, Doug, call it a criminal enterprise. You were a criminal is what you were. Yes, sir, you know. So I really didn't want to take up residence in Walla Walla, so I gave up the best job I've ever had, as far as I'm concerned, you know. But it was in college where I started fighting the booze, and that's when I was 24 years old. Now, I've been drinking for 10 years at this point, and I was drinking at a girl. I know now that I was always dating, going out with women who were drunks just like me. Drinking buddies. I mean, drinking buddies and sex. I mean, that's great, you know. Other than that, there's just seem to be no responsibility or commitment whatsoever. But Margie was, well, she would have turned out to be one of these social drinker types. And I had gotten the ultimatum from her. It's me, you've got, and she didn't say slow down or reduce or moderate your drinking. She said stop drinking. And I made my decision about 10 seconds. It was, well, Margie, don't let the door hit you on the way out. Real nice knowing you. You have a real good life. Because at that point, the idea of her or the drinking, I mean, I knew what was important to me. And it wasn't her. But I drank at her for a long time. And I just reached the point after several months of drinking at Margie that I was just so saturated with booze, I decided to take a day off. You know, a day off from drinking. Doesn't sound like much, does it? And I remember it was a Saturday. I wasn't going to drink on this Saturday just to give it a rest, for God's sakes, is the way I looked at it. And the next morning, I was in the Bulldog Tavern in Spokane, Washington, drinking the first of many hangover beers and looking at myself in the mirror they put there for us to, you know, look at our, stare at ourselves and think about things. And I asked myself this question. I said, how did I get drunk yesterday? I wasn't going to drink yesterday. How did I get drunk? And the answer came. Now, I know it was God revealing truth to me because it came instantaneously and there was no animosity or poison connected to the answer. And that answer was, Doug, you are a drunk. And it was just, whoa. And I knew it was the truth. I absolutely knew to the core of my being that I was a drunk. That I absolutely, and I believe me, I didn't put these words on it, that I was powerless over alcohol. Just instantaneously looked at that past 10 years and said, whoa, I am a drunk. So I figured I was going to drink until I died drunk. I picked up a lot of dead drunks in the Army as a medic over in Europe. A lot of dead drunks. And I didn't know how it was going to come, but I assumed that somehow it would come when I was drunk out of my mind. And I just accepted that and said, well, you know, shoot, words to that effect. Too bad it's me, but oh well. I didn't think there was any way out of it. So that's when I started fighting the booze. There wasn't a day that went by after that. After that revelation, that I didn't know first thing in the morning that I was a drunk. The difference between those days and today is, and then I would say, and now I have to fight it. And I fought it every day. Those insane urges to drink. And I always lost. And it never occurred to me, I didn't know this, is as a sponsor said, and I've heard many a meeting, if you're getting whipped by that 800-pound gorilla every time you get in the ring, don't get in the ring. I didn't know that was an option. I had to get in that ring every day and fight that gorilla, however I was going to do it, you know? Trying to stay away from him, trying to get inside of his punches, you know, whatever I tried to do, the end result is I was flat on my back, drunk again. For the next, I had a long, 24, I had 19 more years to go. Now, you know, no sad stories. I lost nothing financially. You know, I didn't go bankrupt. I didn't do any of that because I had to protect my source to drink. And my source to drink was money. So I made sure, and I've always been blessed with a good head on my shoulders, and I always had enough to drink. I never ran out. When I hear people saying I ran out at 1 o'clock, you know, or my poor buddy Jim trying to figure out how to get to 7-Eleven, hit the beer cooler before You know, everybody goes, aw, you know, I think, you chump, if you let yourself run out of something to drink, you deserve to suffer. It was my way to think. Because I never ran out of anything to drink. Because to me, that was oxygen. That was like taking around an oxygen tank for a fireman going into a big fire. You want that oxygen bottle, I wanted that booze. I drifted in and out of schools and back in the Army again. I have no idea why, but it was, you know, I don't know, but I was just back in the Army again. And Stud got out again and studied some back computers and got a job with a great drinking outfit, the federal government. And 249 days I retired. So I didn't lose any jobs over it. It was, believe me, it was tough and active alcoholism what I was doing because I maintained mainframe operating systems. At the time it was 6 million lines of code. We lost, at the time it was between $1.5 million and $2 million an hour every time any of our computers were down. So they had to stay up. And they stayed up. And my head told me every day when I'd swim up to consciousness, today you're going to get fired. You're going to go in there and you're going to say, Lang, we made a terrible mistake after 10 years. We finally realized you don't know anything about computers. You're out of here. Yeah, that was what my head was telling me. But what was happening out there was I would stagger to work usually. The job got done, the new operating systems went up, and believe me, I'd hear about it if they didn't. Now, some of them were real dicey, but it seems drunks have to put in an awful lot of effort just to do what should not come to be as difficult, but it was because I'd made it difficult on me. We'd go on trips and, you know, say out to Fresno, that was our high volume site. And so you'd been traveling all day, you had to put these things up in the middle of the night. So I just, you know, now by this time I was always traveling with a bottle in my suitcase. But I like drinking in hotel and airport bars. You know, I have no idea because the booze is no better. It's a lot more expensive, but it was just, you felt like you were going somewhere. You know, just not drinking there, sitting there getting hammered again. And, you know, you could tell a lot more lies in a hotel. You know, you'd be anybody you want. But I just want a couple drinks to calm me down, you know. So I get a little bit of sleep, so I go in at 3 o'clock in the morning and put up this new operating system. Well, you know how that goes when we just try to have a drink or two to get to sleep. And I know one time I went into a blackout, and I came out of the blackout, and here I am standing in the here's the computer room, and there are about 30 people standing around looking at me. And it's like the Fresno Service Center is our largest service center in the country. The director was there at 3 o'clock in the morning, and I just come out of this blackout, me and all his buddies and the operations staff, and it suddenly occurs to me, I have no idea if I had already put in the operating system or if I still had to do it. You know, so I'm trying to cover, you know, when you just kind of wake up out of a blackout and you try to find out what's going on without letting anybody know you don't have a clue to what's going on. You know, so I was running, you know, like this and would type in some commands and look and try to figure out what was going on. But, you know, it never occurred to me, well, Doug, you just can't drink before you do that. It was, I'm going to handle it better next time. Maybe if I don't drink in the hotel bar, but drink up in my room, that'll make a difference, you know. So that was usually my answer. I've got to change what I'm, not change the result, but change how I'm getting to that result, and something will be different. Yeah, well, it just didn't cost as much drinking out of my own bottle in the room. That's all it is. You know, I'd still get hammered. But that's what I brought to Alcoholics Anonymous. No financial troubles, and I would keep telling myself, you know I'm a drunk, I know this stuff is killing me, but I still own my house and my car. So even though it's killing me, it isn't too bad. Or I'd wake up out of a blackout and my .38 would be loaded on the nightstand. And I didn't, there's nothing I was doing that I needed a loaded .38. So somewhere in that blackout, I had taken out my .38, loaded it up, and God knows what I'd done with it. I was terrified that I was going to blow myself away in a blackout. Just say, that's it, and just boom. And I was terrified of that, but I didn't do anything about it. It never even occurred to me to separate the ammunition from the weapon, or sell the weapon, or put it in another part of the house. That just never occurred to me. All I could say is, well, I hope I don't blow myself away. You know, so believe me, I wasn't thinking very clearly. My body's falling apart by the 40s. That's just the properties of ethyl alcohol. You drink that much, your body's going to fall to pieces. I'm angry, I'm terrified, I'm just unhappy all the time. The only thing that would give me any sort of relief was the drinking. And I kept doing it. And that's what I took to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had heard it from a family member who was in the program, and I couldn't believe it when she told me that, because, you know, I had a picture of drunks, you know. And it certainly wasn't a nurse. And it certainly wasn't a nurse married to my brother, the millionaire, you know, had it all together, all that good stuff. And she was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it just floored me. But I remember when they were visiting that she wanted to know an address in Annandale, Virginia, where she could go to a meeting. And I just remembered that somewhere on Evergreen Lane in Annandale, you could go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I had no idea. I had no idea what Alcoholics Anonymous was or did. But my sister went there and she had a drinking problem. So one day I went there because I just wanted, again, to cool my jets for a while. I went to this club meeting, slipped in. There was a comfortable easy chair. You know, now they had some tables set up and chairs, these metal folding chairs around the table, and this very comfortable easy chair up against the wall that had a big old ashtray by it. And that's where I sat, away from everybody, had a cup of coffee. By this time, a cup of coffee without a shot or two of Irish whiskey seemed like an awful thing to do to Juan Valdez, but, you know, I went ahead and drank their coffee and smoked a bunch of cigarettes, had no idea what they were talking about, none whatsoever. And I know they got up to say the Lord's Prayer and I was out the door. I had no animosity towards God. I was ashamed and deathly afraid of God. And my head would very helpfully point out, where do you think you can hide from God? Where I'd say, well, at least I'm not killing myself, committing suicide. And my head would very helpfully tell me, what do you think killing yourself slowly with alcohol is other than suicide? That's why I tried to shut this guy up. You know, he could be very antagonistic, but also very perceptive, and I didn't want to hear any bit of it. So, by the third meeting that I attended like that, is I realized what Alcoholics Anonymous was. These people were teetotalers. These people were talking about not drinking all the time, 24 hours a day, before a meeting, after a meeting, during the meeting. They were really big on not drinking. Now, I said, well, I can do this for one or two days, but I heard people talk about years and months, and I just said, not a chance. Because I tried that occasionally, and I knew what happened. You know, you're just inside, you know, and just every day you wake up, and it is gray and miserable, and you know today is going to suck just like yesterday did. And you know tomorrow is going to suck just like today is going to suck. And it just yak, 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 and it seems to be no relief. And that's what I thought sobriety was. White knuckle sobriety, hanging in there. I cringe when I hear anybody saying, I'm just hanging in there. I say, we got to do better than that. for me, that was the way of death, hanging in there. Because I'd hang in there until I just couldn't take that screaming in my head anymore and drink. And I had sponsors, and they were out there. I'm sure they were saying words to me, and I was, you know, just da-da-da-da-da-da in my own head. And I made coffee and did all sorts of things, but it was still motions. I was putting no action on the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I thought this was like advanced AA or extra credit, or for people who understood these books like "You're Okay, I'm Okay" sort of thing. It was just "Don't drink, go to meetings" is Alcoholics Anonymous. That'll get me sober. And for 5+ years, it was demonstrated, no, this will not. But I didn't know what else to do. And I would have been doing that to this day. Or dead. Because that's the my best thinking did not get me into Alcoholics Anonymous. My best thinking got me flat on my back in Fairfax Hospital. Came to on a Saturday in Fairfax. I'd been on a, had been on a 2-day blackout by then. Had several trips by ambulance there, I guess, in the blackout. I had a lot of medical bills, boy, I tell you. And so did the HMO, and I got no squawks about them because they paid those bills. But I woke up on this Saturday, and my design for living at 43 years old had put me flat on my back in Fairfax Hospital. Almost drank myself to death. That's the best I could do with my life. Now, I didn't know my life was going to change in about 30 seconds. And that change came through this book right here. Because when I looked around in this hospital, there was this book right on the nightstand. And I remember that nightstand, it was like every military nightstand, gray, gunmetal, you know, 10-ton nightstand, and this book was sitting on top of it. And I found out later, the man who'd be my sponsor had seen me for several years, you know, he's staying sober, and I'd meet him coming staggering out of Caldwell's, which was my home bar, where I did a lot of my drinking. And I definitely had service positions there, and believe me, I was at my home bar every day. That was for sure. And Greg would see me staggering out of there, and he'd never say, "You gotta stop." He'd just say, "Let me know what's going on," and say, "Doug, if you've ever had enough, here's my name and number." And the last time I'd just been tossing those. Because the last thing an active alcoholic wants is a reminder of someone who's doing it differently and getting different results. But for some reason, I had kept his number. And for some reason, now I wasn't bathing or changing my clothes too often, so I don't know when he'd give me the number and I'd put it in the shirt pocket, but it was still there. And I got it in that hospital. I must have called him up in the blackout and told him I was in the hospital, and he came that night and brought me the book. Now, I was out cold because I had mixed a whole lot of Librium with that vodka. I thought it would enhance the buzz. I had no idea it could kill me, none whatsoever. I ate the whole bottle. Thought, yeah, this will really be cool, man. This will really do something. Yeah, put me out for about 18 hours, it seemed. But the book was there when I woke up on Saturday afternoon. And I picked it up, opened it at random. I didn't like the big book. I had read it drunk and sober. Didn't like it. Thought it was dull. Talked about God all the time. Not drinking all the time. Being around people all the time. It had no pictures in it. It just, you know, didn't interest me at all. But it was $6. I liked that part of it. So I had no favorite passages in the big book. I certainly wasn't looking for any favorite passage that I could read and be inspired. I just opened it at random. And I opened it up to page 30. That's the first page of the third chapter, more about alcoholism. It explains what an alcoholic is, and it explains how to take the first step of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know that. I didn't know the steps were important. I didn't know the directions to take the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous are in the book. Now, I'd been reading that and criticizing it drunk and sober for 5 years, and I didn't know that. Invincible ignorance on my part. But God had beaten through that ignorance somewhere in that 48 hours and put me in a hospital so I could see it. And I saw it. I read a couple sentences off page 30. I have no idea. It didn't even start at the top. Kind of started in the middle. And I read a couple sentences off of page 30. The last sentence I read is, "This is the first step in recovery." And my obsession to drink was simply gone. It was simply lifted out of me. That obsession had owned me body and soul for close to 30 years. And it was simply gone. You know, my best thinking couldn't have done that. I didn't even know what I was doing. I just blindly reached out for a book that I didn't like and opened it at random. And read some words, and my life has never been the same since. Now, I didn't know what was going on. All I knew is I felt a weight off of my soul that I had never felt before. I felt light and safe and protected like I hadn't for decades. It was suddenly things weren't going to be bad anymore. That's all I knew. And then I went to the DTs and I didn't know much of anything for the next 4 or 5 days. But that started my journey in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't grieve for the 5.5 years I wasted. That's just the way it had to be for me. I have no idea why. Why is a management question? Why is a God question? Why is a third step question that doesn't involve me anymore? If I knew why, it would make absolutely no difference, or it would not change the course of action I have to take. I have not once, and believe me, I was a big why guy. You better why to the why? If I could just figure this out, something would be different. Now, it never worked, but I never stopped doing that. It's never occurred to me to ask why I got sober the way I got sober. None of my business. I finally, for whatever reason, recognized the gift that was being offered to me, and I accepted it. Subconsciously, believe me, I didn't consciously reach out and accept any gift. But it looks, from my experience, that God really doesn't need your permission how He will touch the divine in every one of us. Don't have to consciously do this. It worked subconsciously for me. Had to make no decision. It simply came. I surrendered. And that's what I didn't know. And here's the value of a sponsor. The man who brought me that book, who saved my life by taking the action of bringing me this book, explained it to me when I was in detox. And I was explaining this, and just something's different. And he looked at me and he said, "Doug, you finally surrendered. You finally 100% threw in the towel. And in your case, as soon as you did that, that obsession was lifted." That's my experience. It doesn't have to be your experience. And if that wasn't your experience, please don't stop taking the action because that's where the real diversity in Alcoholics Anonymous is. Not our race or color or sex or job or success or lack of it. It's the way God reveals himself to all of us. Is individual. Is personal. To me, I love the first step and I love the third step more than anything. Some people love four and five. Some people are insane enough to like nine. It's none of my business how God reveals himself to anybody who seeks him. You'll never hear me say Alcoholics Anonymous is the only way for an alcoholic to get sober. I'm gonna tell somebody that. Me, who's the best I could do with my life, who's almost killed myself by drinking, I'm not going to say that. I have no idea. But I know that this seems to have an excellent shot at sobriety and discovering a power greater than yourself. Taking action in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd say certainly give that a shot if you've lost the ability to control your drinking. Which page 30 tells me is the only definition of an alcoholic. Not what you drank or how much you drank, or if you went to prison or lost a house or lost a job or lost a husband or wife or any. That's all the incidental. That's the stuff that makes speaker meetings interesting. You know? But that isn't the core. That's just stuff out there. That happens to people who have no problem with drinking whatsoever. But it says on page 30, we alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking. And I say amen to that because that describes me to a T. And that's all I need to know about that. And my sponsor pointed out to me the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I never knew that. Thought it was just don't drink, go to meetings. Well, that might give you a good shot at it. But it's taking the actions as written down in this book that allowed me to have that awakening that allows me to live comfortably in my own skin. I have not had an obsession to drink since that Saturday in that hospital. It has never come back. And that's not because I'm a sweet guy or figured this out or anything. It's because I take the action. If I thought God was a cosmic scorekeeper, I would probably be in trouble. I have no idea what part of Alcoholics Anonymous keeps me in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I know what I'm going to do is I'm not going to treat this like a cafeteria plan. I've also heard that. If you can take what you need and leave the rest, well, if you could figure that out, you wouldn't need to come to Alcoholics Anonymous in the first place. It's because we can't figure out what's killing us as there were in these chairs. I want the package deal because I don't think I'm smart enough to figure out what keeps me sober and what I can discard. And I am not willing to go back to that hell I was in before. So that's what I can live, I can wake up and I can participate in life. I did not participate in my own life. I just kind of drifted through. I wanted to be invisible. I really did. I didn't want to affect anybody, good or bad. I wanted no interaction with anybody. Because my head told me if anybody gets within that close to you, they're going to know you are a loser. My head still tells me that occasionally. And I'm thinking, what's going on that my head's talking to me like that anymore? I've got to take some simple actions, and that's all I got to do. And what I get to do, I'll just take a minute or so and then wrap it up, is, we all have our life's experience, and I don't want to say, oh, life's tough and all. No, life's life. And what I get to do is I get to participate in my own life, the good and the bad. And I get to enjoy triumphs, and I hope I get to learn from my failures. and my failures are usually involve antagonism or resentments to other people because somehow I feel threatened. And it's just, if I can get that, just that split second or sometimes 5 or 10 seconds, say, back off. No, you don't have to act that way. And then if my head wants to, I can say, well, if you were really spiritually fit, you wouldn't have done it in the first place. You know? I just say, no, okay, I can do this better. I got a shot at doing it better. Yeah? And that's what I got. It's and that's, you know, triumphs, failures, and every day in between. You just get to go through it. You get to live it, and I don't want to get through it in the sense of I want it to be over. I want to be able to live my life with some human decency and grace. If I can do that, that's the only scorecard I need. And Alcoholics Anonymous and the God who saved me in that hospital allows me to do that. Thank you very much for having me.